Our conclusions last week were that during the period of the Tanakh, that is from the time of Bereishis until the time of Ezra, basically, the word Ger never meant anything other than resident alien. That is, it just meant the resident alien with certain rights and privileges. The concept of conversion may or may not have existed, but it certainly wasn't something that was, in any sense, a real phenomenon. We have some examples, like the story of Naaman or the story of Ruth. In the story of Ruth, it's not clear that there was any formal conversion. She became Jewish originally by marrying a Jewish man and then by attaching herself to her mother-in-law, and her sister-in-law had the ability to simply return home. There was no moral compulsion for her to stay on. We also saw last time that the one novel thing that we saw towards the end of Bayit Rishon, that is towards the end of Yeshayahu and in Zechariah and elsewhere, is the notion of Judaism as a universal religion. That people are welcome to worship God, and in the beautiful words that we cited last week, that they are sort of part of the religious community, even though they may not be born or officially Jews. But still, even within those, within that framework of ideas, which may be partially eschatological, we don't see any specific reference or examples or laws of conversion per se. Now, I want to describe the next 600 years, and so perhaps I should begin by saying what I think the summary of the situation will show. We will, I think, find, first of all, the beginnings of this period, from the time of Ezra until the time of the Maccabees, or maybe 100 years before the Maccabees, or maybe just after the Maccabean period. Our own sources are extremely obscure. It's a period which is just simply not clear to us from our text. And in reading the texts, when was Ezra, when was Nehemiah? How do they stand within one another? What are their dates? I think the scholars can come to some agreement now as to what the relative dates are, but it's certainly not something that's apparent from within the text. And what happened from the time of Ezra and Nehemiah to the time of Shimon HaTzadik? I mean, there are several hundred years of Jewish history which is certainly not clear to us. And for that, to some extent, we have to rely on the external documents. And for this entire period, I will rely, since I don't read Persian or Greek or even Latin, for that matter, with any degree of fluency, but it's the Persian documents and the Greek documents which are the most important, I will rely on the scholars that I trust, and the one scholar that I trust is Bickerman. So we will, to a great extent, at least for the first half of the shiur, rely on him, at least in his judgment, because he actually has read the original documents, and furthermore, he has an overall picture. Whether you agree with his picture or not, and I tend to agree with his picture, at least he has a global conception plus the technical skills of actually reading the documents. Now, so what we will find is that even from the period of Ezra until the period of the Maccabees, there also is no evidence of conversion as a process actually taking place. There may have been isolated incidents of it, or it may not have existed at all. But from the period of the Maccabees until the time of Josephus, which where we will start to examine our texts, there was a massive conversion. That is, there was a massive spreading of the Jewish people, as we said, something like from a couple of 100,000 to 8 million.
What years are we talking?
Well, the beginning of the Maccabean period, you could say, is 166 before the Christian era. And Josephus is writing right after the revolt, so let's say 70 or 80 of the Common Era.
And
Ezra Nehemiah, approximately? Ezra Nehemiah. Ezra was about 550, plus or minus, before the question era. And if you put Nehemiah a couple of generations after that, then you're talking about 100 years later or less. And as I'm saying, from that period, from 550 BC down to about 200 BC, we know very, very little from within our own sources. But there are certain things that we do know. For example, we know that there was the exile of the 10 tribes 100 years earlier by Sargon or whoever. Then there was the further exile from Judea of many people on the part of Sanherib. And the first thing to notice is that the existence of a Jewish dispersion, which was then for the first time something that was happening within Jewish history, was not a unique phenomenon. That is, there were many dispersions.
Other people
were scattered all over the place and retained their identity. Okay? Let me read to you what Bickerman has to say on this subject. The Jewish diaspora was by no means unique. It met a Greek dispersion everywhere, from Sardis to Elephantine. There was similarly an Aramaic and a Phoenician diaspora in Egypt, and surely elsewhere. And long before Alexander the Great, the emigrants from Egypt and Sidonian merchants had settled in Athens. Nor were the Jews the only people transferred to new places by Assyrian, Babylonian, and Persian despots. The Eritreans, too, were carried off from Greece by Darius I in 490 BCE and settled in the region of Susa. 150 years later, their descendants in Persia still spoke Greek and still remember their ancestral home. Nor were the Jews alone in weeping for the native city. Every people, or a fragment of people, thrown into a foreign land, continued to worship its ancestral gods. Baal and Nabu, gods of Babylon, were brought by emigrants to Elephantine on the southern frontier of Egypt. A Phoenician woman living at Tachpanes in the Nile Delta asked on behalf of another woman not only the blessing of all the gods of her current place of sojourn, but also the blessing of Baal Zephon, the god of her native land. Aramaean immigrants living at Memphis in the 5th and 4th centuries BCE had their own cemetery where they depicted themselves on their gravestones in Syrian dress. It could hardly be otherwise, Bickerman writes. The tribal organization of Oriental peoples blocked the road to assimilation. Royal permission was required to reckon the children of a devoted Greek nobleman and his Persian wife as Persians. True, as time went by, individual immigrants... A deported Greek nobleman and his Persian wife had children, and according to the Persian bureaucratic regulations, though the children followed the father, and therefore those children should be considered as Greek. And it required some official document, which Bickerman has obviously found, to illustrate his point, to allow the children of the Greek father to be counted as actual Persians. Good evening. Okay. True, as time went by, individual immigrants or their descendants were absorbed into the people among whom they lived. But legally, immigrants remained sojourners, just a technical word for gerim, and the various communities of immigrants never lost their original identities. The Paeonians deported from Macedonia to Phrygia, Herodotus says that they lived in a village by themselves. The descendants of the settlers transferred to Samaria by Assyrian kings remained Urukians, and Susians were Elamites in the official language of the Persian government. They only resided in Samaria. Newcomers everywhere constituted separate communities. Mesopotamian colonists in Syria, near Aleppo, and Palestine continued under Persian rule to draw up cuneiform deeds according to the Babylonian legal system. A ruler, Sagan, of the Carians in Mesopotamia is mentioned in cuneiform tablets of the Persian period. Okay. So that's the first thing to realize.
How long did they last?
Several hundred years, at least.
So what was unique about the Jews?
Nothing.
They're still around.
Well, there are several things that were unique about the Jews. And what happened, one of the things that was unique about the Jews, of course, was their refusal to accept the local gods. So the rejection, although not all Jews were completely religious in this, but there was still a refusal on the part of the Jews to accept the local gods, which delayed or prevented absorption. And the second thing, of course, were the events that we're about to describe, namely the Edict of Cyrus. That the Jews were then allowed, or by royal decree, to return to their land. So let's now read, not the Edict of Cyrus itself, because there's a very detailed analysis of Cyrus's edict in the handout by Bickerman, in the handout that I've given you, but let's read the Edict of Artaphashtal, which is also mentioned in Ezra. So let me just read this to you. I didn't pass this out. Va'ant Ezra, this is now reading from Ezra. Va'ant Ezra k'chachmat Elohach b'biyadach, according to the wisdom of God that is in your hands, m'ni shaftin v'dayanin d'lehavon danin l'chol amadi v'avon nara, that they should be magistrates and judges for the entire people that is in the district of Eivah HaNahar. Remember what the word Eivah HaNahar means. It's a district in Persia. It's that part of Persia which is west of the Euphrates. When we say the Eivah HaNahar in the Haggadah, it's not referring to across the Jordan River, it's referring to a Persian district, namely that district of the Persian administration that was west of the Euphrates. So the Eivah HaNahar Goa Avotenu Me'olam is referring to an actual district within the Persian administration. And Artaxerxes writes that.
So if Ivrianochi, that Abraham said, meant that he came from.
What the word Ivri means is a very big dispute amongst the various scholars. But what is not in dispute is what the word Eivah HaNahar means. Eivah HaNahar is a district in Persia referring to that administrative district which is west of the Euphrates River. Okay. In any event, the king writes, "The Ant Azra kachachmat elahach b'viyadach meni shaftin v'dayanin v'lahon danin l'chol amad v'eva hanahara l'chol yodei datei elahach, to all people who know the laws of your God, v'dilo yadat hahodon, and all of those who don't know the laws of your God, let them know them." And all who will not observe the laws of your God, the data bi malko, and the laws of the king, asapalna dina lohu metabad mana, you should rapidly inflict punishment on them, hein lamut, whether to kill, hein l'shal shol, there's a difference of opinion what l'shal shol means. Rashi translates to kill the whole family, but perhaps it means simply to exile, hein la'anash nechsin, or monetary punishment, v'la'asumin, or put them into jail. In other words, there's a royal edict on the part of the king Artaxerxes, however you pronounce it in English, the Hebrew, your Aramaic or Hebrew pronunciation is probably closer to the Persian, giving Ezra the right to enforce the laws. Okay? Now let me again read to you what Bickerman has to say on this subject. Fragmentary and insufficient as it is, our present evidence about self-government on the part of minorities in the Persian Babylonia allows us to understand the meaning of the clause in Artaxerxes' instructions to Ezra. The scribe of the law of the God of heaven is empowered to appoint heads and judges who may judge his people beyond the river Euphrates, who know the laws of your God, to teach those laws to men who do not know them, and to punish transgressors. This formula demonstrates that self-government in the Persian Empire was established by royal decree, that it was valid only for the territory explicitly named in the decree, that the authorities established by the decree could punish transgressors and even put them to death, as the story of Hosanna, and as long as their decision did not conflict with the king's laws, and that, in the case of the Jews at least, nationality was defined by religion. So here we have a clear definition of to whom people, the Jews, are belonging, namely they're characterized by the people who worship the Jewish God. For Artaxerxes, Israel was synonymous with the people who worship the God who was in Jerusalem. We may surmise that the Egyptians in Babylon would be men who worshipped the gods of Egypt in that city. I would add that the reference to Petachia, who is at all kings handle matters concerning people, points to some kind of overseer of Jewish affairs operating in the course of Susa. So there was an what was happening within the Persian Empire, where the people were not judged according to some kind of universal Persian law. Each community had its own intrinsic laws, together with various laws that came from the central administration. The communities were identified by their religious observance, and according to Bickerman, it was most unlikely, if not impossible, to transfer from one such community to the other. So on the one hand, we have the identification of the Jewish people as a nation, but this nation is in and of itself defined by its religious beliefs. So this was the situation, I would imagine, without strong evidence, from about 500 before the Christian era until about 200 before the Christian era. Now, let's take a look at a drastically different story where we can read the original sources, that is, the English translation from the Greek of Josephus, and this I have here, so let's read these passages as we go along. Okay, all right. Let's read 7 or 8 of these 11 or 12 passages from Josephus so that we just get a picture. So my first excerpt is from the book Against Appian. This was a piece of counter-propaganda. There was an anti-Semitic book written attacking the Jews, and this is Josephus's answer. Then he attributes to us an imaginary oath, and would have it appear that we spared by the God who made heaven and earth and sea to show no goodwill to a single alien, above all to Greeks. So this was the classical attack on Jews as the enemies of mankind. Having once stated false accusations, he should have said, show no goodwill to a single alien, above all to Egyptians. For then this reference to the oath would have been keeping with his original fiction, if, as we're given to understand, the cause of the expulsion of our forefathers by their Egyptian kinsmen was not their malice, but their misfortunes. From the Greeks, Josephus writes, we are severed more by our geographical position than by our institutions, with the result that we neither hate nor envy them. On the contrary, many of them have agreed to adopt our laws, of whom some have remained faithful, and others, lacking the necessary endurance, have again seceded. Of these, not one has ever said that he has heard the oath in question pronounced by any of us. Appian is apparently the only man who has heard it for the good reason that he invented it. But what he is saying is that many Greeks have adopted Judaism, some of them not being able to hold to it, and gone back.
What does he mean by oath? They're swearing at him or something
like that? Appian accused the Jews of taking some oath to hate the Goyim. And now he's just responding to that.
That's what it was said. Alleged Jewish oath of hostility to
the Greeks. Okay. Now, let's look at my next quotation on the same page. The consideration given by our legislator to the equitable treatment of aliens also merits attention. It will be seen that he took the best of all possible measures at once to secure our own customs from corruption, and to throw them open ungrudgingly to any who elect to share them. To all who desire to come and live under the same laws with us, he gives a gracious welcome, holding that it is not family ties alone which constitute relationship, but the agreement in principles of conduct. So therefore, anyone who agrees to abide by the Jewish code of behavior is welcome within the Jewish community. On the other hand, it was not his pleasure that casual visitors should be admitted to the intimacies of our daily life. So it's another illustration of the fact that converts were accepted. All right? Let's take a look at another quotation from the same book. On the next page, page 2. In my page 2. In 2 points in particular, remember there was an old let's call it fiction or belief by the Jewish philosopher Aristobulus that the Greek philosophers got their ideas from Moshe Rabbeinu. Whether this has any validity or not, this is something that's sort of behind the scenes in Josephus' argumentation here. But he's now comparing the Jewish laws to the principles of Plato. In 2 points in particular, Plato followed the example of our legislator. He prescribed as the primary duty of the citizen a study of their laws, which they must all learn word for word by heart. Again, he took precautions to prevent foreigners from mixing with them at random and to keep the state pure and confined to law-abiding citizens. Of these facts, Apollonius Malone took no account when he condemned us for refusing admission to persons with other preconceived ideas about God and for declining to associate with those who have chosen to adopt a different mode of life. Yet even this habit is not peculiar to us. It is common to all and shared not only by Greeks, but by Greeks of the highest reputations. The Lacedaemonians made a practice of expelling foreigners and would not allow their own citizens to travel abroad, in both cases apprehensive of their laws being corrupted. They might perhaps be justly reproached for discourtesy because they accorded no one the rights either of citizenship or of residence among them. We, on the contrary, while we have no desire to emulate the customs of others, yet gladly welcome any who wish to share our own. That, I think, may be taken as a proof both of humanity and magnanimity. So he is establishing again that whereas we're not necessarily tolerant of other people's beliefs in the sense that we have to accept them or share them, we're willing to welcome anyone who wishes to join us. Okay? Let's take a look at the next quote, which is even more striking. You can't make a telephone call.
Phone
is out. Yeah, it's been out by Shabbos. I hope that's supposed to be back in. The ice simply broke it. Now, since time is reckoned in all cases the surest test of worth, I would call time to witness for the excellence of our lawgiver and of the revelation concerning God which he has transmitted to us. An infinity of time has passed since Moses, when he compares the age in which he lived with those of other legislators. Yet it will be found that throughout the whole of that period, not merely have our laws stood the test of our own use, but they have, to an ever-increasing extent, excited the emulation of the world at large. So he's now making the case that throughout the entire world, and I guess for Josephus he means the Hellenistic world, the Greek world, our earliest imitators were the Greek philosophers, who, though ostensibly observing the laws of their own countries, yet in their conduct and philosophy were Moses' disciples, holding similar views about God and advocating the simple life and friendly communion between man and man. But that is not all. The masses have long since shown a keen desire to adopt our religious observances, and there is not one city, Greek or barbarian, nor a single nation to which our custom of abstaining from work on the seventh day has not spread, and where the fasts and the lighting of lamps and many of our prohibitions in the matter of food are not observed. So again, you see that he is saying that there is a widespread acceptance of Jewish beliefs and to some extent even practices throughout the Hellenistic world. Now, this idea of partial acceptance, he makes a little bit, that is, people who are sort of what in the McCarthy era you would call fellow travelers, becomes apparent in the next selection on my page 4 from the Jewish War. The Assyrians on their side, this is whatever event this was, the Assyrians on their side killed no less than a number of Jews. They too slaughtered those whom they caught in the towns, not merely now as before from hatred, but to forestall the peril which menaced themselves. The whole of Syria was a scene of frightful disorder. Every city was divided into two camps, and the safety of one party lay in there anticipating the other. They passed their days in blood, their nights yet more dreadful in terror. For though believing that they had rid themselves of the Jews, still each city had its Judaizers, who aroused suspicion. And while they shrunk from killing offhand this equivocal element in their midst, they nevertheless feared these neutrals as much as pronounced aliens. So there exists a class of people within these cities who are not really fully Jewish, but nevertheless are sympathetic to Jewish ideas and traditions.
When was Mordechai? Would you agree that it was around this time still?
No, I mean, Mordechai in the story is projected back a few hundred, 300 or 400 years before this, right?
Well,
Mordechai is in the Persian period.
Are you talking about the Greek?
He's talking about 100 or 200, 100 years before his own time, or whenever. I don't remember precisely which event he is referring to in here. Yeah, I think the word Nisyahadin, however, in the Megillah is best translated as pretended to be Jewish. A whole lot of people
out of fear
pretended to be Jewish, right? I think that's the simplest translation. I don't think that we have to accept the idea that it means that they actually converted to Judaism. I think
if I remember, this is in the period right before the temple was.
Yes.
Before.
Yes. Let's take a look on the next page. In his page 517, on my page 5, continuing to receive similar treatment from later monarchs, the Jewish colony grew in numbers, and their richly designed and costly offerings formed a splendid ornament for the temple. Moreover, they were constantly attracting to their religious ceremonies multitudes of Greeks, and these they had in some measure incorporated within themselves. So again, you see, there was a large attraction of the Greek community to Jews, okay? Let's take a look, let's ask my page 7. Now we see some examples in Josephus' history of forced conversion. He's now referring, I believe, here to Aristobulus' conquests, and he writes, "And he had scarcely had he spoken these words when he died in his reign of 1 year with the title of Philhellene. He conferred many benefits on his country, for he made war on the Aetolians and acquired a good part of their territory for Judea, and compelled the inhabitants, if they wished to remain in the country, to be circumcised and to live in accordance with the laws of the Jews." And, I mean, this is not the only case, of course. John Hyrcanus also, according to Josephus, did the same. Let's turn to the next page, which is a story which is enlightening to us, but mainly because it's a story that Josephus himself particularly likes. So let's spend 10 or 15 minutes just reading through this whole story. At the same time, Helena, queen of Ariadne, and her son Izathes became converts to Judaism under the following circumstances. Monobazus, so named Dazius, king of Ariadne, seized with a passion for his sister Helena, took her as his partner in marriage, and got her pregnant. On one occasion, as he was sleeping beside her, he rested his hand on his wife's belly after she had gone to sleep, whereupon he thought he heard her voice bidding him to remove his hand from her womb so as not to cramp the babe within it, which, by the providence of God, it had a happy start and will also attain a fortunate end. Disturbed by the voice, he at once awoke and told these things to his wife, and he called the son who was born to him Izathes. He had an elder son by Helena named Monobazus, and other children by his other wives, but it was clear that all his favor was concentrated on Izathes as if he were an only child. In consequence of this, Izathes' half-brothers by their common father grew envious of the child, a typical story, and he sends the child away, and so on. Let's turn to the next page. After the child is sent away, when he's about to die, he calls the child back, and the question is whether to kill the other brothers or not. Let's not go into the details of all of that. Let's go to my page 10. So this will give a picture of actual events. Now, during the time when Izathes raised in Charax Pasini, that was the country to which he had been sent by his father with protection against his brothers who might have evil designs on him, a certain Jewish merchant named Ananias visited the king's wives and taught them to worship God after the manner of the Jewish tradition. It was through their agency that he was brought to the notice of Izathes, whom he similarly won over with the cooperation of the women. When Izathes was summoned by his father to Ariadne, Ananias accompanied him in obedience to his urgent request. So here you have a traveling salesman who's presumably dealing mainly in women's finery or perfume or what have you, who is converting the women to the ideas of Judaism, and this also led to the influence on Izathes. It so happened, moreover, that Helena had likewise been instructed by another Jew and had been brought over to their laws. When Hizates came to Adiabne to take over the kingdom and saw his brothers and his other kinsmen in chains, he was distressed at what had been done, regarded it as impious either to kill them or keep them in chains, yet thinking it hazardous to keep them with him if he was in prison, cherishing resentment as they must. He sent some of them with their children to Claudius Caesar and Rome as hostages, and others to Adiabnus the Parthian king with the same excuse. When Hizates had learned that his mother was very much pleased with the Jewish religion, he was zealous to convert to it himself. And since he considered that he would not be genuinely a Jew unless he was circumcised, he was ready to act accordingly. When his mother learned of his intention, however, she tried to stop him by telling him that it was a dangerous move. For, she said, he was a king, and if his subjects should discover that he was devoted to rites that were strange and foreign to themselves, it would produce much disaffection, and they would not tolerate the rule of a Jew over them. Besides this advice, she tried by other varied means to hold him back. He, in turn, reported her arguments to Ananias, that was the traveling salesman, and the latter expressed agreement with the king's mother and actually threatened that if he should be unable to persuade Hizates, he would abandon him and leave the land. For he said that it was afraid that if the matter became universally known, he would be punished in all likelihood as personally responsible because he had instructed the king in unseemly practices. The king could, he said, worship God even without being circumcised, if indeed he had fully decided to be a devoted adherent to Judaism, for it was this that counted more than circumcision. So it was the religious, the philosophical beliefs that counted more, according to this traveling salesman, than the actual circumcision.
Rambam hold that too, is there a real danger?
Well, that's something else, but here it's not clear. He told him furthermore that God himself would pardon him if constrained thus by necessity and by fear of his subjects, he failed to perform this rite. And so, for the time, the king was convinced by his argument. Afterward, however, since he had not completely given up his desire, another Jew named Elazar, who came from Galilee, and had a reputation for being extremely strict when it came to the ancestral laws, urged him to carry out the rite. So there was another traveling salesman who was a little more frum than the first one. But when he came to him to pay him his respects and found him reading the law of Moses, he said, "In your ignorance, O king, you are guilty of the greatest offense against the law, and thereby against God, for you ought not merely to read the law, but also even more to do what's commanded in it. How long will you continue to be uncircumcised? If you have not yet read the law concerning this matter, read it now, so you should know what an impiety it is that you commit." Upon hearing these words, the king postponed the deed no longer. Withdrawing into another room, he summoned his physician and had the prescribed act performed. Then he sent for both his mother and his teacher Ananias and notified them that he had performed the rite. They are immediately seized with consternation and fear beyond measure that if he should be proved that he had performed the act, the king would risk losing his throne, since his subjects would not submit to government by a man who was a devotee of foreign practices, and that they themselves would be in jeopardy, since the blame for his action would be attributed to them. It was God who was to prevent their fears from becoming realized. For although Hizates himself and his children were often threatened by destruction, God preserved them, opening a path to safety from desperate straits. God thus demonstrated that those who fix their eyes on him and trust in him alone do not lose the reward of their piety. But I shall report these events at a later time. And then he goes on to describe the events of Helena and how many wonderful things she did, and stories that are certainly confirmed in our tradition in the Gemara and the Midrash and what have you. So obviously, in writing this, Josephus is having a wonderful time telling the story that he is delighted in telling, but the phenomenon is clear, namely Jewish salesmen, merchants, and what have you, are spreading the Jewish religion through all over the world, even in a far-off place like Adiabne, and there is a receptive audience. There's a receptive audience throughout the Hellenistic world.
What is the time and location?
Well, here I xeroxed for you on the next page the article in the Jewish Encyclopedia on Adiabne.
Oh.
So according to the Jewish Encyclopedia, these events were taking place between 36 and 60 in the Christian era, the Common Era.
Well, what is the word for conversion actually mean? That's translated, conversion actually mean in the Greek?
I'm not a scholar in Greek. We will discuss a little bit of the meaning of the words in Greek in a moment, but maybe now is as good a time as any. And again, I will quote from Bickerman. So in his discussion, in Bickerman's discussion of this translation of the Septuagint, Bickerman writes, and third, because the Greeks employed their own political terms, so now we're back to about 250 BCE. And third, because the Greeks applied their own political terms, polis, demos, ecclesia, phile, and others, when describing the organization of foreign societies, the 70 could not avoid some of this terminology if they wanted to be understood by their readers. This results in that the result is that in the Septuagint, Kiryat Arba becomes a polis in the age of Abraham, and the word polites, citizen, is used by Ephron the Hittite for the Hebrew sons of my people. Yet other terms current in Greek political language of that time, for example, Ionia, loyalty, Thrasybetes, ambassador, Samakia, are never used by the Alexandrian translators. Why? The truth is that the use of Greek political terms by the 70 frequently lacks precision. While it is easy to understand that they regularly rendered two biblical terms for the community of Israel assembled, Kahal and Eidah, by the vague word synagogue, which can be applied to any gathering of crops as well as of men, it is not easy to understand why the term kahal in Deuteronomy is sometimes rendered in Greek as synagoge, synagogue, and sometimes as ecclesia, that is, popular assembly. Still, when they had to deal with terms of practical importance for their readers, they could be careful. The common Hellenistic term for resident alien was paroikos, and it is used by the 70 in two different situations. When the original speaks of a Hebrew who is residing, toshav, or sojourning temporarily abroad, and when the lawgiver specifies the religious duties and rights of a stranger residing among the Jewish chosen people. But when the Torah speaks of the stranger in Israel, and when the community of Israel is described as a temporary sojourner in a foreign land, the 70 use the word proselytos, proselyte, our word proselyte, incomer, or more precisely someone who comes over, which has not been found in non-Jewish Greek yet. In other words, the Targum Tirgum HaShivim invented a new word, proselytos, to describe this phenomenon of a geir, of someone who comes over. The usage of the Greek Pentateuch reflects the legal situation of the Jews outside Judea and of the non-Jews in Judea at the time of the translation. Since no foreign cult was tolerated in the Holy Land, only an alien in Jerusalem who agreed to worship the Lord could be a parikos there in the full sense of the word. But the Jew residing in a foreign country was welcome to worship his deity there. Thus the 70 refused to blur the difference between the Greek and Hebrew institutions. For the same reason, they abstained from using the crate, etc., etc. Okay, so the point that he's making is, again, there had to be a new word invented in Greek to describe this phenomenon of someone who comes over. That's another indication that this was something that was a novelty of the Hellenistic era, and we have to understand why, and is explicitly mentioned in the Targum HaShivim. I cite one non-Jewish source here just again to illustrate the existence of this notion of Judaizers. It's an unpleasant citation, but there was a man, what is this magazine, People magazine, where they describe all the famous people. Well, it was a guy named Plutarch who wrote the corresponding thing in Roman times, and I guess as all the heroes all the really famous, good, important people are lawyers, he had a book devoted to Cicero, who was a lawyer by profession and by fame, and in his description of Cicero, he cites how witty Cicero was because he made a joke, namely that there was a person who was suspected of Jewish practices, and who denounced the person by the name of Verus, and the word Verus means pig in Latin, and Cicero was brilliant to say that, you know, what does a Judaizer have to do with pork? So this was to show that even Plutarch was able to make sort of a slightly offhand anti-Semitic remark, but it was referring to the practice of sympathizers. Another let me see if I have this. Another more vicious anti-Semitic remark is the statement of Jesus in the in Matthew, but again it shows the existence of a certain phenomenon where Jesus says, "Woe unto you, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites, for you compass sea and land to make one proselyte, and when he is made, you make him twofold more the child of hell than yourselves." So the fact that he's viciously against the Jewish religion, and someone who's converted to Jewish religion goes to hell doubly more than someone who's born into it, well, we can reject that as a typically anti-Jewish comment, but the fact that he's describing a phenomenon of people going out and actually actively propagandizing for the Jewish religion, we might accept that as being illustrative of an actual event. I'll have one other citation. Let's now go to citations from Philo. Here, I thought it would be better for me to deal with Wolf's and summary of Philo's position, rather than trying to collect all the sources from Philo myself, since Wolfson does it so well. So let's turn to my page 16, and let's read a little bit of what Wolfson has to say on the subject. So Philo is discussing the notion of what constitutes Jews and aliens, citizenship in the Jewish community, etc. So on my page 16, Wolfson's page 354, under the man-made constitutions of discussed by Aristotle, he would seem to argue, a citizen must have the ability not only to be ruled, but also to rule. And it's because of this concept of citizenship that Aristotle demands that certain native-born inhabitants should be excluded from citizenship on the grounds of their occupation. And it's probably also because of this conception of citizenship that no definite law for the admission of aliens to citizenship is offered by him. Citizenship, according to Aristotle, could be conferred on aliens only by the goodwill of the people. Under the divinely ordered constitution, however, Philo would seem to say, a citizen is he who is willing to be ruled by the law. No one born under the law can be excluded from citizenship. No alien who's willing to accept the law can be refused citizenship. Moreover, under the divinely ordered constitution, the rights of temporary aliens and resident aliens are well defined by law. In the Mosaic state, as in the states dealt with by Aristotle, there are two classes of citizens. The first class consists of native-born Jews. These, says Philo, form a nation, ethnos, composed of 12 tribes, phyli, being descendants of the 12 tribal ancestors who are connected not by being merely members of the same household or by mere kinship, but being all brothers and one of the same father. Native-born Jews are therefore described by him as fellow nationals or fellow tribesmen or kinsmen or simply as native-born, which is the term generally used in Scripture. Members of the assembly of this kind are all equal before the law, every one of us eligible to pay any office, and is excluded from no privilege. Let's skip a little bit. Members of the assembly of the second kind are described by Philo in the Septuagint term proselytes, that is, those who have come over, and also by the term epilites, that is, those who have come in. These Moses calls proselytes, he says, because they have come over to the new and God-loving polity. And the epilites, he said, are those who have taken a journey to a better home from idle fables to the clear vision of truth. With the exception of certain restrictions in the case of Ammonites, Moabites, Edomites, and Egyptians, all aliens are accepted at once into the Mosaic polity on equal terms with the native-born Jew. Drawing on the verse in which the Septuagint reads, the proselyte who cometh to you shall be as one born among you, thou shalt love them as themselves, he says, Thus, while giving equal like to all incomers with all the privileges which he gives to the native born, he exhorts the old nobility to honor them not only with marks of respect, but with special friendship and with more than ordinary goodwill. He commands all members of the nation to love the incomers, not only as friends and kinfolk, but as themselves, both in body and soul. The admission of proselytes on equal terms with the native-born Jews into the Jewish polity indicates, according to Philo, that the basis of that polity is not common descent, but rather the common heritage of the law which was revealed by God to the people of Israel. Even the native-born Jew is a member of that polity in the full sense of the term membership, not only because he's a descendant of the stock that founded that polity, but also, and primarily so, because he remained loyal to the Jew, which is the heritage of that stock. The native-born Jews, he says, obtain the approval of God not because they are members of the God-loving polity from birth, but because they were not false to the nobility of their birth. The proselyte obtains his approval because they have thought fit to make passage to piety. And if I skip to the next page, in Wolfson's page 358, he's in describing the klala, the proselyte who is with thee shall rise higher and higher, but thou shalt fall lower and lower. The proselyte, he says, will be exalted because he has come over to God of his own accord, while the nobly born, who has falsified the sterling of his high lineage, will be dragged down to the lowest depths, in order that all men behold this example may be corrected by it, learning that God received gladly virtue which grows out of ignoble birth, utterly disregarding the original roots. If we go to Wolfson's page 364, my page 21. Within this Mosaic polity, in which citizens are those who are the sons of God in the sense of their willingness to serve God and follow Him in the observance of His laws, there is also room for three other classes of people who are neither native-born Jews nor proselytes. First, there is the alien, who in the Septuagint is described by the term Alogenus, or Alotrius, which it translates to Hebrew term Ben-Nechar Nachri. He is mentioned in the legal portions as the Pentateuch as one who is not allowed to eat of the Passover, to whom the Jew is not allowed to sell the Jewish maidservant, to whom anything that dies of itself